You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features on the cover a previously unpublished photograph of Barbara Streisand by Richard Avedon, shot on April 1st, 1970. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Now, here's the editor's letter from Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief, with photograph by Mark Seliger. Was it a fever dream, or did she really sing a few bars of The Way We Were to me in her living room to illustrate a point? When I met with Barbara Streisand in Malibu in July to discuss her memoir, My Name is Barbara, we quickly got onto the topic of that classic love story, which turns 50 this fall. In the excerpt features it in this issue, she tells the story of making the film with Robert Redford and reinstating two previously cut scenes, which she's been storing in a personal vault all this time for a re-release on the occasion of the film's anniversary. Streisand's memoir is as expansive and unique as her career, and she holds nothing back, from her lifelong struggles with her mother to the collaborations with filmmakers that helped determine her path as a director, to her various charming obsessions, vintage Edwardian clothing, men with great teeth. She told me that, true to her conversational style, she ad-libbed jokes while recording the audio version. At the time we met, 2 days before Hollywood's actors voted to strike, she was worried about whether she would have time to edit it before the release date. Her vaunted perfectionism is the stuff of legend, but I would argue that the through line of her career is actually persistence. In our time together, certain themes emerged. Don't call yourself an artist before your time. It's phony. It's presumptuous. Focus on process. Art is not about the product, but the work it takes to get there. This perfectionism, it's really just determination to follow through on her directorial instincts and deep love of character. It's understanding that live performance shouldn't stagnate. It's wanting to try something new, new blocking, new intonation, in case some magic happens. In a way, it's the inverse of perfectionism. It's knowing that nothing is perfect, so there's always a reason to keep pushing. So, the song. The first time Marvin Hamlisch, the composer, played The Way We Were for Streisand, she loved most of it. That first line of the melody was sensational, she writes, but the second line went down the scale, and Streisand thought it should go up. That's how she heard it in her head. That's where she found the emotion. Sure enough, Hamlisch agreed, and her way is the way we've all heard it ever since. The term Streisand effect has a very specific meaning in online culture. The unintended amplification of a story through efforts made to suppress it. Its roots come from a lawsuit Streisand brought over an invasive photograph of her home on the internet. She explains the full context in her book. Streisand, who is the opposite of very online, told me the first time she heard that term, she hoped it was about the effect of her music on her fans. For the headline of our interview, we've refitted it to our purposes. To us, the Streisand effect is about being exacting in the service of excellence. It's about persisting when people tell you you're too old to play the part, or too much of a woman to hold the camera. It's about digging deep and digging in when you know you're right. And it's about the inimitable effect Streisand has had on just about every form of entertainment our culture has to offer. Here are some of the issue's contributors. Christian Farias, Reign Supreme. I've written about the Supreme Court and the politics shaping it for as long as I've been a card-carrying lawyer, says the legal journalist and founding editor of Inquest. All along, I've marveled at how much of my formal legal education has been rendered irrelevant by the court John Roberts leads. Madeline Weeks, Atsuko all the way. We laughed the entire time, says the costume designer and founder of sustainable faux fur brand First by Madeline, of her experience styling Atsuko Okatsuka. She was super excited to wear stunningly glamorous designer looks while flying over the football players. Bethany McLean, The Moonshot. Joe Nocera and I started working on The Big Fail, published by Portfolio, in those dark days of spring 2020, says the journalist, known for uncovering the origin stories of some of America's biggest blunders. We weren't sure where we were going, but we knew that the pandemic would have an enormous economic impact. Eric Johnson, hip-hop's Renaissance man, the award-winning photographer best known for documenting American music culture of the late 1990s and early 2000s, has been following Fab Five Freddy since Debbie Harry rapped Fab Five Freddy Told Me Everybody's Fly in Rapture. He helped pave the way for my entire generation, he says. William Ralston, the hand that rocked the cradle. For the London-based journalist who specializes in long-form investigations, following the trial of Lucy Letby was a chilling but fascinating experience as the true extent of her cold-blooded, manipulative actions came to light. Nicole Rifkin, the Rothschild who wasn't. Throughout her artistic process, the New York-based illustrator asked herself what it would feel like to be fooled by someone like Kyle de Rothschild de Chanel. It felt all-consuming, she says. I wanted to convey that when someone does something like this, it causes fractures across your life. Lorraine Nicholson seeks the decadent and debauched, with photographs by Eric Ray Davidson. L.A. Lady, Lorraine Nicholson on Being Raised by the Hollywood Wolves, by Britt Hennemuth. I believe my parents had a full-blown party in the room at Cedars-Sinai, says filmmaker Lorraine Nicholson of the day of her birth, because adults are constantly coming up to me saying, "I was there the day you were born." The late Robert Evans snapped a photo of her father, Jack Nicholson, with her in his arms. 2 days later, her mom, Rebecca Broussard, crashed a luncheon celebrating his fresh fatherhood at the Polo Lounge, wearing garters to show she still had it. A real California love story. 33 years later, Nicholson is chronicling what usually makes L.A. confidential, with a feature in the pipeline based on the life of an exotic dancer who married a Ponzi-scheming money manager, lost everything, and built herself back up. And she's creating a podcast about the 80s-era nightlife impresario Helena Kalianotis, who was an Eve Babbitt's muse. And then there are Nicholson's dinner parties. Guest list eclectic and strictly classified, establishing the host as a doyen of Hollywood, old and new. Between writing time and a women-only Tai Chi class, she squeezes in French fries and conversation in a corner booth at the Beverly Hills Hotel. Hugh Hefner's kids were her childhood best friends. At the Playboy Mansion, you could order any food you wanted. I would order pounds of mashed potatoes and peas. When she was growing up, her father drove golf balls into the canyon and then sent the kids to collect them. He prepared for his role in Mike Nichols' Wolf by howling and attacking the car as she left for school. She once lost her journal outside and got it back with a new inscription. "Dear Lorraine, you left this in my driveway. Love, the fat man next door." Her neighbor, Marlon Brando. The Brown University grad flirted with acting. "Everybody around me were performers. It didn't even occur to me to do anything else." But lacking that trusting nature, she pivoted to directing. Her 2017 short, Lifeboat, appeared at the Tribeca Film Festival. I'm drawn to the female scumbag. Her pull toward LA eccentrics stems from the larger narrative of choosing your family in the Wild West. That's one thing I love about our wonderful city. Thank you. plunge. Kalita Rawls's daughters are her muses in the L.A.-based painter's A Certain Oblivion, a meditation on resilience, opening this month at Lehman Maupin, New York. Here, she shares more inspirations. Renaissance, Beyoncé, 2022. The album is on repeat in the studio, says Rawls. It gives me energy, fire, life. Forrest Gump, 1994. The film, starring Tom Hanks, is my stranded island movie for how it shows the little things a person can do that can make a major impact in the world. And his ability to stay focused was his key to success. It seems simple, but we all know how hard that is. Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel, 2022. The novel has recently been added to my list of favorites, Rawls says. It plays with time, perception, and reality, subjects I've always been interested in. First Blush by Daisy Shaw Ellis, with photograph by Lorenzo Meloni, Bulgari High Jewelry, Mediterranean Serpentine Earrings. On a 1910 sourcing expedition to Madagascar, Tiffany and Company's chief gemologist George Kunz discovered a new stone, a cousin to emerald and aquamarine tinted Turkish delight pink. He dubbed it Morganite, in honor of one John Pierpont Morgan, financier by trade, gemstone collector at heart. And while its popularity has been widespread since, Bulgari creative director Lucia Silvestri's Mediterranean collection, which features 7 Morganite pieces, is the first time the color Happy House has incorporated it with such gusto. A new sibling handshake between LVMH's 2 premier jewelers, perhaps. Amid a gemstone rainbow, the warm pink stands out for its ability to offset the crispness of brilliant-cut diamonds, as shown here in the house's trademark serpentine earrings. Surely Mr. Morgan would approve. Now, here's what's trending. Princess Diaries. Audiences are bidding the crown farewell upon its final season, but the royal family's ultimate style icon endures. Tailored denim, prim cable knits, and a little black revenge dress will never go out of fashion. Pictured here, English lit, Merritt Solo Shadow in mid-century, Bottega Veneta sweater, Loro Piana jacket, Prada dress, Savette bag, Victoria Beckham coat, diptych, Le Monde diptych, refillable scented candle in La Vallée du Temple, Chloe sweater, Sydney Garber cuff and bracelet, Vacheron Constantin watch, John Lobb shoes, Necessaire, the body retinol, Pomeletto rings, Giorgio Armani pants, and in another photo, Princess Diana on her visit to Klokniće, Bosnia and Herzegovina in 1997. Free Bird, a stylish new film celebrates the enigmatic sex researcher Cher Height by Keziah Weir. In the photographs, in Paris in the 1990s, Cher Height forged an ongoing creative partnership with the photographer Iris Brush, as exemplified here at the Louvre. Height at her desk following the 1981 publication of the Height Report on male sexuality. In Paris, with a friend in Manhattan on New Year's Eve, 1984. I'm not trying to give her sole credit for the discovery of the clitoris, but she really changed the public dialogue in a way that was profound, says Oscar-nominated producer and director Nicole Newnham of Cher Height, the subject of her new documentary. The way she looked and dressed and acted was as revolutionary and as important in some ways as the work she did. In 1976, the former Columbia Graduate School student published the Height Report, a qualitative survey of more than 3,000 American women, with questions such as, "Do you think that sex is in any way political?" and "Do you ever fake orgasms?" In the New York Times, Erica Jong wrote that Height laid out how sex really is right now. Her work, which promoted more fluid conceptions of gender, vaulted Height into the public eye. Oprah, Mari Povich, The Nightly News, often opposite famous and skeptical men. A young David Hasselhoff dissolves in stutters as Height, all apricot curls and black lace, smokes coolly beside him. Yet there's a disappearance of feminist knowledge systematically, says Height's peer, National Women's Health Network co-founder Phyllis Chesler, in the film. By her death in 2020, Height had largely faded from the American consciousness. The disappearance of Cher Height, in which executive producer Dakota Johnson gives voice to her writings, summons her back. In Height's days, as a conflicted model, her Modigliani features glow in Playboy and reference shots for the 1971 Diamonds Are Forever poster. After the Height Report, she bought an Upper East Side apartment where she hosted gatherings attended by Gloria Steinem, Donna Summer, Flo Kennedy, and Gene Simmons. She preferred Rachmaninoff to the Rolling Stones and printed surveys in ink that matched her vermilion nails. America, though, was not quite ready for Height, who eventually decamped to Europe, where photographers embraced her multi-genre maximalism. Following backlash to the 1981 The Height Report on Male Sexuality, which its editor, Robert Gottlieb, called one of the saddest reads of his life. The disappearance shows a Harvard lecture attendee prodding Height about old nude photos, and on Oprah, an audience of men excoriate an embittered Height for her methods. After she went to Oprah's favorite thrift shop as consolation, what really scares people, reads a Guardian review of her 2000 autobiography, The Height Report, on Cher Height, is the fact that she is a beautiful, clever, sexy, self-made woman. Are we ready now? Ideas that were so radical and scared people so much about Cher's work have become internalized by younger people, especially, Newnham says. Fall fashion embodies Height's range, from Miu Miu's stayed glasses plus underwear as pants to Rock's deconstructed office garb. Ongoing assaults on bodily autonomy may demand a louche counterpoint. In one scene from the film, Height lounges on her pink brocade couch and kicks off her heels as Johnson's velvety narration plays over directions Height once wrote against becoming a stereotyped creation of your society. They include, don't laugh at any of your desires, rely on your own financial resources, enjoy yourself a lot. Sense of Style by Laura Regensdorf, with illustrations by Ben Panicha. I see fragrance as an extension of my wardrobe, says Victoria Beckham, whose collection this fall goes beyond deconstructed trench coats and plush turtlenecks to include three debut scents. You are tapping into all the senses when smell becomes a factor. It's how you dress yourself. There is merit to having a signature perfume, an aide-mémoire that lingers in your absence. But a cache of design-minded fragrances makes the case for a sartorial array. Here, six tastemakers riff on their creations, imagining which clothing item best reflects what's worn on the wrist. Gabriela Hurst, Paysandu. The Uruguay-born designer expands her brand this fall with two fragrances created with Fueguier in 1833. Both scents, Paysandú and New York, are pieces of my childhood, my memories, and my soul in a way, she says. A nod to her motherland, Paysandú is a resinous blend layered with jasmine del país and the medicinal herb carqueja. She sees it with a knit wrap from her line, made by artisans from the nonprofit Manos del Uruguay. Friedrich Mahl, Heaven Can Wait. To Mahl, Heaven Can Wait reads like second skin. It's a mood rather than a moment, he says, of the latest by perfumer Jean-Claude Elena, evoking intimacy and warmth with notes of clove, carrot seed, and iris. The fragrance seems to find its textile equivalent in bed linens and little else. Mahl instead suggests a worn-out sweatshirt, unfussy in its deep comfort, to accompany this very soft yet textured perfume. Tori Birch, Essence of Rose. I design fragrances the same way I design my collections. They are tools for self-expression, says Birch. Her new scented oils, odes to rose, sandalwood, and vetiver, ideal for layering, stoke that creative impulse. Her favorite is a calibrated mix of Bulgarian rose and bergamot, akin to nailing the ideal balance of silhouette, fabric, and fit in a jacket. Fall's two-piece ivory look with exposing boning strikes the same tone, romantic and sensual. Victoria Beckham, Portofino 97. Fragrance for me is emotional and subjective, says Beckham, who calls her trio of perfumes extremely personal. Sweet 302, Tobacco, Black Cherry, conjures a night in Paris. San Isidro Drive, Saffron, Incense, captures a stretch of L.A. life. This citrusy postcard from the Italian Riviera recalls her first trip with David Beckham, young lovers escaping the limelight. An aquamarine dress for fall, adorned with a plume, fits the occasion. Armando Cabral, Mahogany Cora. The designer and model collaborated with perfume studio Diaz & Durga for this limited edition, featuring notes like papyrus, atlas cedar, and calabash nutmeg. It takes me back to the 60s in Mali, a time well documented by the great Malian portraitist Seydou Keita, says Cabral. For him, a soft texture white suit projects a sense of elegance and depth, echoing the fragrance's sophisticated nature. Love Shack Fancy, Forever in Love. Once the type to faithfully wear a signature perfume, founder Rebecca Hessel-Cohen came to appreciate the idea of an olfactive wardrobe. It's just like your actual closet in fragrance form, different scents for different seasons, moods, times of day, she says. Of the three new scents, Forever in Love is her morning pick. It's gardenia and green pear, so open and optimistic. The brand's ruffle miniskirt mirrors its flirtatious personality. My Stuff, Hot Shot, Clippers point guard Russell Westbrook keeps it stylish on and off the court. In the photos, Style File, Watch, Rolex Day-Date 40, Eyewear. While I was in Paris this summer, I bought a few frames from the Swedish company Shimi, including the Lab Black. Daily uniform, stamp inner city t-shirt and pipeline ankle pant. From my brand, Honor the Gift. Sneakers. I have my own signature shoe line with Jordan and have been able to create different shoes and colorways that I love. On grooming, body wash, Dove body wash. Shampoo, whatever my wife uses, I use hers. Razor, I don't shave. Never have shaved in my life. I'm baby-faced. At home, furniture. I have a custom bed. I travel a lot for work, so it is always nice to come home to your own bed. Artwork, a painting in my home by Henry Taylor. 3, resting, a different work from Taylor. He is a black artist from L.A., and I love how all of his pieces have a message and a narrative. For pleasure, listening to my wife's podcast, The Relationship Chronicles with Nina Westbrook, watching Hijack on Apple TV+, movie night with the kids, The Little Mermaid, the new one, the kids only watch TV on the weekends, playlist, L.A. artist mostly, Blax, Bino, Kendrick, Nip, Young, travel, luggage, Rimowa and Tumi, vacation destination, Los Cabos, Mexico, it's calm and my kids love it, hotel, Four Seasons is consistent worldwide, car, Porsche 911 Turbo S, the menu, morning, beverage, green juice with kale, cucumbers, turmeric, and orange juice. Breakfast, I like waffles and fried eggs. I eat a bowl of berries with breakfast every day. Restaurant, Hillstone. Candy bar, payday. Indulgent drink, Sprite. Cocktail, I don't typically drink. Power snack, I have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich before every game. Keziah Weir writes on books, fight songs. In a crowded field of political books, POTUS 45 looms. As the election countdown begins, a flood of books look backward to investigate intra-party conflict. Jonathan Carl traces Trump's reascension to Republican frontrunner and tired of winning, Donald Trump and the end of the grand old party, published by Dutton. While in Where Have All the Democrats Gone? The Soul of the Party in the Age of Extremes, published by Holt, which name-checks the former prez 304 times, Rhee Teixeira and John B. Judas argue for centrist ideals in the face of lefty radicalism. There are takes on Trump's media footprint, including Vanity Fair special correspondent Brian Stelter's Network of Lies, the epic saga of Fox News, Donald Trump and the Battle for American Democracy, published by Atria One Signal, and Collision of Power, Trump, Bezos, and the Washington Post, published by Flatiron, by former editor Martin Barron. Other books make the political personal, as in McKay Coppin's authorized biography, Romney, A Reckoning, and Liz Cheney's Oath and Honor, A Memoir and a Warning, and in Tracy K. Smith's standout, To Free the Captives, A Plea for the American Soul, published by Knopf, the former poet laureate revisits a family history of enslavement to interrogate what being of this country really means. Can we yet train ourselves, she writes, to admit the past more fully and honestly? Six-pack, inventive novels explore love and loss without clichés. The future, doomsday preppers, one-upping tech scions, fake news, and environmental activists collide in Naomi Alderman's apocalyptic pandemic-ridden page-turner, published by Simon & Schuster, The New Naturals, and Gabriel Bump's melodic story of attempting to heal following the death of their newborn daughter, a pair of married academics builds on underground utopia. Published by Algonquin. Baumgartner, from Paul Auster, A Day of Ominous Signs, leaves a lasting impression on a widowed professor. Some months later, a dreamed visitation from his late wife changes his romantic trajectory. Published by Grove Atlantic. The Happy Couple, Noosha Dolan's droll exploration of the lead-up to a London wedding, peers into the entwining life of a young couple, from her beautiful ex to his initial reluctance to wed, published by Echo. Same Bed, Different Dreams. Ed Park's blisteringly entertaining newest entangles a mythic manuscript, a sprawling Korean provisional government, and a veteran cum sci-fi novelist to brilliant effect, published by Random House. Family Meal. In Houston, a pair of complicated childhood friends reconnect. One has lost a boyfriend and spirals into addiction in this evocative study of food and love from Brian Washington, published by Riverhead. Hot Seat, in her new memoir, Discomfort Queen Zeewe Gets Personal, by Chris Murphy. How many black friends do you have? It's the question that launched Zeewe, the mononymous comedian, late-night television host, and interview provocateur, onto the national stage. While she made a name for herself as the question asker, Zeewe is full of answers in her debut essay collection, Black Friend. I don't love sharing anything about me, and I didn't want it to be personal, Zeewe tells me, but obviously you really can't hide behind 200 pages. So you're forced to reveal parts of yourself and be vulnerable. That was a hard pill for me to swallow. The self-exposure paid off. In Black Friend, she plumbs the depths of her own experience to deliver thought-provoking essays about topics as salient as affirmative action, as scary as getting harassed by a stranger in the woods, and as silly as Wikifeet. I am not a supporting character, she writes. I am the protagonist of my perfectly imperfect story. The result? An absolutely iconic book. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico, Interval Selections by Mark Hoffman.